Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.
Hello and welcome to Wireless, the series all about radio, broadcast on the first Monday of every month on Flirt FM 101.3 in Galway and on flirtfm.ie. I'm John Walsh and I'll be with you for the next hour. Wireless covers all aspects of radio, analogue and digital, community, regional and national broadcasters, niche broadcasting, pirate and alternative radio, radio diversity and the history and future prospects of the medium. Coming up on the November edition of Wireless, we look back at what has been a momentous month for Irish pirate radio and we report from the Craol Féile of Community Radio in Athlone.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
It's been a significant month for Irish radio history, and here at Wireless on Flirt FM, we're delighted to be part of it. Last month, two big events were held in Dublin to mark the development of an Irish pirate radio archive in order to preserve and safeguard the country's pirate radio heritage. On October the 2nd, it was announced that a large collection of press clippings and other documents and materials from the pirate era would be donated to Dublin City University. The donation was announced at a press conference in Dublin, organised by old friends of this programme, Eddie Bowen and Brian Green. The press conference featured some well-known radio and media people who cut their teeth in pirate radio. And here's an extract from the event.
Good afternoon and welcome to Buswells for this special Irish Pirate Radio Archive press conference. My name is Stuart Clark, the deputy editor of Hot Press and a former pirate myself with the likes of ABC Radio, Hits 954 and the Warfrey Radio Caroline, who, lest we forget, was started by an Irishman, Ronan O'Reilly, and fitted out in Gronor in 1964. Now, the golden age of Irish pirate radio ended in 1988 when, and you're allowed to hiss and boo now, the Wireless Telegraphy Act was introduced. Prior to that, Radio Nova, the Big D, Radio Dublin, Boyneside Radio, Radio Limnee, Community Radio Yole, South Coast Radio, Sunshine Radio, Radio Carousel, Radio West, Bray Local Broadcasting, Cavan Community Radio, Radio Leinster, Radio North, Royal County Radio, and countless more had enraptured the nation and changed radio here forever. The pay wasn't always great. It was never great, but working on them was a massive adventure. Now, to mark the 30th anniversary of the close down, the Irish Pirate Radio Archive, part of which you can see all around us, is being donated to DCU. Mark O'Brien from the DCU School of Communications, how big a deal is this for you?
It's huge. It's phenomenally huge. We're delighted and very grateful to Eddie and Brian and all those who are contributing to the Irish Pirate Radio Archive and donating their material to DCU. The heyday of pirate radio, as you mentioned, Stuart, was in the 70s and 80s. Every parish, literally, small town, village, had their own pirate radio station. And I think it constituted local radio, community radio, before those terms became fashionable or even invented. So on behalf of DCU, we're delighted to receive this material. The material will be going into the Media History Collection, which is part of the special collections at Dublin City University. And from Friday, it will be available for the public to look at. Some of the exhibition you see around you here today will be in the O'Reilly Library at DCU. And so people are more than welcome to come along and view the material. And again, we're just absolutely thrilled as a university to receive this really, what we consider to be really rich media history material, and it will be of interest not just to Irish scholars but internationally, because I think pirate radio is not just an Irish phenomenon, it's a global phenomenon, and so we're absolutely thrilled and delighted to receive this material.
Thank you. Declan Meehan, you were breaking the law way back in the 70s with the likes of Radio Melinda. Paint a picture of licensed broadcasting back then and what you offered as an alternative.
Yeah, I first went on the air in 1970, officially. And I say officially because it was a station that was there every week. And that was Radio Vanessa from Santry with a guy named Robbie Irwin, who's just recently left RTE, so we've known each other all our lives. Then it moved on to Radio Melinda. And Radio Melinda was in Sean McDermott Street, and we got raided for that and fined £2. But the radio situation that we wanted to change was the monopoly of Radio Éireann at the time. And it wasn't long before that Radio Éireann was on from 8 a.m. till 10 every morning. And then there was a gap between 10 and 1. Then there was 1 to 3 with sponsored programmes, and you might even hear a popular record on it. Then between 3 and 5, nothing. And Radio Éireann back on the radio again at 5 in the evening. And this was broadcasting. In the swinging 60s, the Beatles were happening. Offshore radio had just happened with Radio Caroline, and Ireland was so far behind. And whereas people maybe in the country saw themselves as particularly Irish with Irish music and Irish culture, there was a growing number of teenagers who allied themselves more with what was happening in maybe Detroit or Atlanta or something, blues singers and Tamla Motown and the swinging 60s and Liverpool, etc. So we skipped Ireland and we wanted to recreate what the Pirates did, which was this international culture of playing popular music for young people. And we wanted to replicate the Pirates in the absence of the broadcasting scene, as previously described. A little bit later on, RTE filled in the gaps, and they had Larry Gogan was given more programmes, etc. But it was pretty bleak.
I love the test case that was taken by Radio Dublin, and basically what it was, if you could, you know, prove an alternate use for your transmitter, it was that. So it gave off light, it was a light. It gave off heat, it was a heater. And that was the loophole exploited for quite a few years. Kevin Branigan, CEO of the licensed Radio Nova, you also have a pirate pass and would have known Chris Carey quite well as a youngster.
Well, I was only just, you know, in, you know, at the start of the 80s, I'd have been quite young. I was born in 1972. So for me, as somebody who was interested in radio from the age of 10, you know, we used to have lots of hi-fis and radios in the house, so I became interested in it. So I suppose just for, you know, for a young boy, age 10, 11, 12, who was interested in radio, being around in the early 80s was a fantastic time, because you literally had a band full of radio stations, from the smallest radio stations up to the largest ones, like, you know, the likes of Radio Nova and, you know, the Sunshine Radios and all the rest. And I guess for me, as somebody who has ended up being involved on a full-time basis in the radio sector, it certainly could not have been a better situation to have been in, where you heard these large professional radio stations providing a professional service, which was really something which for me had stood out and has I suppose it prompted my interest in radio. I suppose in relation to, you know, meeting Chris Carey, I met Chris Carey a number of times. I used to visit the original Radio Nova up in Rathfarnham. I used to cycle up on my bike on my half day from school on a Wednesday afternoon. And I suppose, you know, people would often speak about listening to Radio Luxembourg under the covers. For me, I would listen into Radio Nova under the covers, because why would you listen to a medium wave signal fading in and out when you had this monster radio station, which was even better than all the international radio stations, which was up the road in Rathfarnham. So I'd cycle up. I was always very excited about what I saw there. There was a sense of energy in the place, and I think that if you look back on the broadcasting, which was done by the original Radio Nova and the original Sunshine, that it would certainly stand up today. And I think it has formed the basis of all of the standards which we've seen that have come through the commercial sector over the last 25 to 30 years.
Declan, a quick contrast and compare between Radio Vanessa and primetime Radio Nova.
Oh, right.
Chalk and cheese.
Okay. Could I just say, when you mentioned we didn't get paid that much, Chris Carey was probably one of the best payers of ever come across, and his big boast at the time was, my jocks have been paid more than Steve Wright on the BBC, which seemed to be something that he wanted to achieve, and we didn't object. Radio Vanessa was looking at the window all the time to a man who used to drive a Volkswagen van and worked for the Department of Post and Telegraphs, who would be looking around to try and close down the radio station. You'd nip on for an hour or two every weekend and do your best, but stay on. You'd be afraid of being reported by your neighbours or something like that for playing pop records. There was the advantage that all the women around to an impressionable teenager on the air, you know, increased your sort of currency when you're grown up and being a teenager. Turning to Radio Nova, Radio Nova was a real radio station. Before getting the breakfast show on that station, Chris Carey sent me away with my girlfriend at the time to the west coast of America, and he said, you're working. And I said, well, what's the job? And he says, I've got a condominium in MacArthur Avenue in Santa Ana, and your job is to sit in the jacuzzi all day with a big radio that's in the condominium, and it's tuned to Kiss FM. And he says, when you come back, you are part of Kiss FM. And we had this ethos of this West Coast American sound, the style of the DJs, the non-intrusion when you're playing records. But it was, I described it before, like the Beatles. There was, Ireland was in recession, yet at the time there was so much money circulating around Radio Nova that advertisers were knocking on the door, can we please advertise? We were in charge of our own competitions on the breakfast show, and you'd have travel companies like, say, I don't know, Budget Travel saying, would you please knock off that Fun Trek competition you have, because we will have a better competition, and of course there's one in it for you. And there was this sort of feeling that Radio Nova was just bigger than anything else. People used to just give us, I suppose, you know, adoration to a degree, if that's the correct word, with for being on the air on this radio station that everybody knew. It was just a phenomenon.
Declan Meehan of East Coast FM in Wicklow, and formerly of the Pirate Radio Nova, speaking in Dublin at an event to mark the donation of the Irish Pirate Radio Archive to DCU.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
Now to our monthly Radio Retro feature, which of course features a pirate recording for the month that's in it. We'll hear shortly from someone who was involved in the successful Waterford local radio WLR in the 1980s. Like other stations, WLR closed down at the end of 1988 as the new broadcasting legislation came into effect. This recording is of the owner of WLR, Des Whelan, who closed the station down at 6 p.m. on the 30th of December.
Okay, it looks like that we got about 3 minutes or less to go, so Des Whelan is in the news booth, and I know he's got a few words which he's collected and put together, and we're going to hear from Des right now.
This is meant to be recorded, but I think we're going to do it live. I've an awful lot of people to thank. It's with great sadness, obviously, that WLR closes today. But I think it's also with a sense of relief that at last, after 10 years, local radio is about to get its long-awaited licence. We've been broadcasting continuously since 1978, and since then the station has become part and parcel of everyday life in the South East. And while I've no doubt that our listeners will miss us and the service we provide, I can assure you that we will miss broadcasting to you even more. WLR is not alone the country's longest established local radio station, but also one of the most successful. Nowhere else in Ireland has a radio station made such inroads in both the community and commercial life of an area. For this, I'm grateful, and I mean this, to the wonderfully talented people who have worked here on WLR over the past 10 years. Many have come and gone, many, thankfully, onto bigger things too. But most have stayed, and in an environment that has often combined insecurity with hostility, those pioneers of local radio stuck with it and have paved the way for the successful introduction of legal local radio to this area. While I am confident WLR will secure a licence, whatever happens, it's WLR that has made legal local radio a reality. I have many, many people I wish to thank, those that work here, definitely the best and most talented staff any station could have. Our advertisers who've always supported us, many in times when it was frowned upon to do so. The good people from the community who've taken part in our programmes and encourage us in our work every day. And more than anything else, I want to thank you, the listeners, for without you, there would have been no WLR. In an independent survey of the radio audience in the Southeast, conducted by one of the top market research companies in the country just 3 weeks ago, WLR held 65% of that audience each week, against 43% for RTE Radio 2, 41% for RTE Radio 1, 26% for ABC Radio, and 2% for NCR. Proof, if there needs be, that local radio for this area is a must, and that WLR, already with 65% of the weekly radio audience in this area, are definitely the ones to do it. I would also like to thank those members of the community organisations who helped create the Southeast Broadcasting Company and those organisations that have supported its plans. I would like it to be known that WLR has never, ever, ever been comfortable having to break the law to provide a service that politicians, in their short-sighted way, were incapable of legislating for. I commend the current government for the forthright way they have tackled the situation. I would also like it to be known WLR owes no taxes, has or will leave no debts of any sort. I'm extremely proud of this radio station and what it has become. It is professional, informative, entertaining, and in this area, there is no doubt that it is more popular than any other radio station on the wave band. It has, I believe, contributed significantly to the cultural and social life of this area and has created the foundation for the introduction of a legal local radio service, which otherwise would be a pipe dream. Finally, when questioned in that independent survey on who should get a local radio licence for Waterford City and County, 77% surveyed said WLR. Let us hope that the people get what the people want. Thank you very much.
That was Des Whelan.
Des Whelan closing the pirate WLR in Waterford on the 30th of December 1988. And Waterford listeners did get what they wished for because WLR went on to win the Waterford licence and is still headed by Des. That recording is courtesy of dxarchive.com. And that's this month's Radio Retro feature. We'll have another gem from the archives next month.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
On October the 20th in Dublin, a group of us organised a pirate radio meetup to record oral histories of those involved in the pirate era. The recordings will eventually be added to the Irish Pirate Radio Archive. Over 100 former pirates turned up for the meeting at the Ballsbridge Hotel in Dublin. The meetup was the idea of Brian Green, and I was delighted to get involved and record interviews myself, some of which we'll feature over the coming months on Wireless. One of those I spoke to was Owen Renane, formerly of WLR in Waterford.
In Waterford in the late 70s and into the 80s was a pretty depressed place. We'd had a lot of job closures. There wasn't a music scene as such. There were cabaret bands, cover bands. We had the ballroom in Tremore and a ballroom in the city where the show bands would come. But there really wasn't any great music scene. And there certainly wasn't, as you know, any radio. And this story is probably told 1,000 times over across the world, across the country. But in Waterford, we would have, and I would have, listened to the likes of Radio Caroline, 208 Luxembourg, BBC One, in the early 70s. I can distinctly remember Tin Lizzy playing in the Ardrey Hotel, which looks over the city of Waterford, and it coming across to me. So, but we wouldn't have had a music scene. So we were aware to our friends, who were friends of mine who did their leaving in 77, went to college. I used to go to Dublin. For Waterford people, going to Dublin is a reasonably common enough thing. You would head to Dublin for the scene, for the nightlife. So we were aware there were pirates in Dublin. And then in 1979, a guy called Rick Whelan, who was a local DJ in Waterford's only nightclub, opened a radio station in his farm out in Killotter, in his dad's farm. And his brother Des Whelan, who's now the chief executive of WLR-FM and of Beat-FM, they set up a radio station with a guy called Edio Gianni, who was an Italian. All three went to school in Water Park, where I went to school. We all went to school together. They set up a station. And a few of us who were involved in youth work, I'd left school at the stage. I was working in a place called Milton Bradley Ireland, MB Ireland. They made games like Operation and whatever. I was in the purchasing department. I had declined to go to college for a range of reasons when I left school, although I'd intended to go and do politics and history to do journalism, but I ended up staying in Waterford. We tried to set up a station called Radioactive Waterford. We bought all the gear. I think they were called Citronic decks, or mixers. We put all the gear together. But the transmitter was the problem. We found a TV engineer around the corner from me in Thomas Street. I lived in the centre of town, who agreed to rewind the transmitter, the transformer, the modulation transformer, from a ship's transmitter that had come ashore on the beach in Tremore. And he had taken the ship's transmitter and he'd agreed to rewind it for us. We got a 257 crystal cut in England, but we couldn't get the damn thing to work. We tried to broadcast from a place called Ballymacaw, which overlooks the sea at Dunmore East, near Dunmore East, between Dunmore East and Tramore. So that didn't work. And at the same time, Jack O'Keefe, who was a DJ with WLR, went to school with Des and Ricky and myself and others who were in Waterpark together, decided to open an alternative called Shoreside beside the River Shore. And they asked me would I come on board, and a couple of others who were involved in the aborted attempt to launch Radioactive Waterford, or RAW. So that's how I got involved. And I used to leave my job in Milton Bradley and drive, and I was 19 at this stage. I would have been about 19 going on 20. I would leave at 5:15, drive across the town, which wasn't difficult in those days, to the north side of the River Shore, to a farmhouse just around the corner from the city, from Cromwell's Rock, where we had our studio. And I'd do 6 to 7:30. And the programme was kind of pop music, rock music, and interviewing youth groups, young people, my own age, really. I was very involved in youth work. So that went on for about 10 months, and then I was asked by WLR would I come across to join clearly the bigger of the two stations.
And just before you talk about WLR, was Shoreside then a more community station, or was it kind of a hybrid operation? What did it sound like?
It presented itself more as a community station, and it certainly advertised itself as that. I'm not sure that it was much different, to be honest to you, than WLR when you look back on it. And I have some of the old recordings. I don't think there was a great deal of difference. I think there was personality issues, maybe at the top of the organisations, you know. But I do remember from that era, that was the era of the raids. They were happening pretty fast, thick and heavy. So WLR would get raided 1 week and we'd get raided the next week. And I distinctly remember driving to Dublin in my father's car to pick up a replacement transmitter from, to this day, I'm pretty sure was an employee of the Post and Telegraphs, who was probably involved in seizing one of the transmitters in the first place.
So you were going to take it back, were you?
We went to Dublin and picked it up at, just outside the GPO, and brought it back to Waterford and went back on air. That happened a couple of times. They cut down the masts a couple of times, and we all mucked in to put them back up together again, and all the rest of it.
So were you there for any of the raids then? Were you actually present?
Raids tended to happen during the day, so I was never there for a raid. I was working at a day job. So I missed out on the raids, but when you think back on it, and when I ended up in a career in broadcasting, how slipshod, how on the back of a piece of paper it was, you know. But there are great stories, and they're in those books. I mean, we didn't even have the wherewithal to make commercials. In Shoreside, we had to shut down the station to make commercials to run. And I distinctly remember, because I got into running bands, I used to book bands. There was nothing in the town. And then the Showboat, which is a pub in the Glen in Waterford, decided it would run a rock night on Wednesday nights. So I got involved in booking bands for that. And in fact, had I became notorious, I suppose, for it in our world. But I got involved in booking bands, and I brought U2 to play in the regional college for the princely sum of £300. But we did lots of bands, right? And so I would do that on a Wednesday night. I'd interview them, bring them back and play them. But I had Horslips playing what was to be their last gig in the Waterford area in 1980. And we had to close the station at Christmas to make ads. And I was in making an ad in the studio proper. What I didn't know was that they had turned on the transmitter, which is in the room behind me, which I couldn't see. And the whole city heard the make and remake and multiple remakes of the Horslips ad with plenty of expletives, because they kept intruding to say to me, listen, your drink is going warm, and because it was Christmas. That went on, and apparently the whole city was in stitches listening to this thing. But that kind of nonsense happened.
So was it fairly low power then? Was it a low? Do you know anything about the technical side of things? How strong was the transmitter? I presume it was just AM, was it?
It was only AM. And there's a story around going FM. It's only AM initially. We were on 257, and WLR was on 252, I think. It couldn't have been more than a couple of kilowatt. It was quite weak. It only really, and same for WLR, we only really reached a 15-mile radius around the city, out to Tramore, Dunmore, Kilmacthomas, and that was about it. And Shoreside would have been weaker than WLR. The story of FM is around about the same period, again around the 1980s. There was a guy came down from Dublin. I'm sure many of the Dublin people here today will probably know the guy I'm talking about. I don't remember his name. But he came down from Dublin to build an FM transmitter. And we were going to move the studio from the country on the north shore of the river looking into the city. We were going to go to a higher point, Ballybricken, which is the hill smack in the centre of Waterford, to put the FM transmitter up on a height. And a guy came down from Dublin to build it for us and spent 3 days building and failing to get it to work. But he spent the same 3 days living on cough mixture. And we're pretty sure that he obviously had a drug habit of some sort. It failed dismally. But I remember him being horsed back to Dublin on the train by the guy who owned the radio station because it was an absolute failure. But I mean, there were these mad stories when you think about it. So I moved to WLR.
When would that have been?
That would have been in early 1980s. Okay. They had decided that they were going to clean up the act, professionalise, and go for the licence. And as you know, there were several attempts by various ministers to get that moving, and it never happened. I left WLR subsequently in 1987 to through a public competition to end up working in RT in the newsroom, initially on 2 FM News and then staying there until 1994 as a journalist. But I had gone full time. I had gone with a job to Apple Computers in Cork in 1985. I had been working part time, mainly weekend work or nighttime work, late night programming. Mainly music, but with a certain amount of interviews, band interviews, interviews with visiting bands when they were available. And then an opportunity to... The job folded in Cork. I was coming back to Waterford. Des said, listen, we want to launch a news service properly. Will you come back? Initially, I came back, did a bit of work in the newsroom, worked selling ads, but it went full-time. It was a major cut in salary. It went from the princely sum of 13,500 in Apple down to something like about 5,500 or 6,000 to work for WLR. But it opened the door, and there's no doubt about it. We made a determined decision to get the news service into a shape that would be acceptable in terms of assessing the organisation for the future.
How did you do that?
Well, OK, the first problem was we couldn't get an NUJ card. And in those days, particularly, the NUJ card was a passport to an interview. And the local journalists in the southeast branch of the NUJ had effectively put a ban on anybody working in local radio being not allowing them interview people who work in politics. So in other words, all the TDs, while initially in the very early days, were very happy they used to take out ads. I remember particularly a European election campaign where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael both advertised with WLR. That stopped. And then the interviews with the local TDs stopped on foot of pressure from the local branch of the NUJ, mainly, and from the local papers, the owners of the local papers. So we couldn't get to the main source of news in political life anyway. So we had to find other ways around it. And there was a lot of plagiarism. There's no question about that. News stories would be run, typed from the RTE bulletin or typed from the front page of the local paper. And when I came in, you know, I had a friend who had worked with me in Shoreside under the alias of Dave James, who had gone on to work as Jerry Foley, which is his real name, in Today FM. Today Tonight with Joe Mulholland in RTE, and had been very successful, and had ended up working as a political correspondent with TVAM in Belfast during the height of it in the 80s. And with a bit of help from Jerry and others, we began a programme of trying to make our news service acceptable, and that meant immediately ending the lifting of material. So if we did lift, we credited it. So bulletins went from a news bulletin which just copied what was in the local paper to a report along the lines of, it says in the Munster Express today that, right?
How did Munster Express take to that? Did they object? Or
well, they couldn't really, because it was effectively advertising their paper for them for free. So it worked. And we gradually, over a period of time, began the process of tidying up the news service. But I was working full-time, and trying to get into the NUJ was the problem. They didn't want to let us in because they didn't see us as legitimate. By that stage in the 80s, in the middle 80s, in Dublin, the branches in Dublin, the PNPR branch, had begun to accept pirate radio news people into the union.
From Radio Nova.
From Radio Nova and elsewhere in Dublin, yeah. And they had come into the union. So Barry McCall, who was a very active member of the NUJ in Dublin in that branch, he was branch chair, came down to a local meeting in Waterford, and we went through about three meetings. And I had to bring all my work and my tapes and my transcripts. And on three occasions, I was turned down. And finally, after Gerry Foley came from London, or from Belfast, and these were all established members of the NUJ at this stage, they came down to vouch for me, and I got in. So I was going to my second branch meeting in not long after. This would have been in 87. It took me from 85 to 87 to get into the union. And I had a certain smile on my face at the second meeting because I was actually coming to figure out how do I transfer from the South East branch to the RT Dublin Broadcasting branch, because I got a job in RT. And
But the important thing is that you got into the NUJ when you were still in WLR.
And I was still in WLR, and I had been there for full-time for 2.5 years and got in eventually. And there was, at that stage, a loosening of the relationship between local papers and the station. I think the writing was on the wall. This was now 87. If you think about it, it was 2 years later that the Act was being put into effect. So there was a thawing of the relationship, an improvement of the relationship with working journalists, a recognition that we were now crediting them and not ignoring the fact that they had actually produced this work. And that helped. And I think to a degree that was, without being too big-headed about it, partly my influence, because we had made a decision that we were going to go legit, that we wanted to get the licence. It happened for me that I managed to get a job in RT before that all happened. And ironically, or maybe deliberately, I happened to be working for Morning Ireland on the evening that the stations closed. So the next morning I had put together a package for to mark the closure of the local stations across the country. And in fact, the station we used as an example, one of the examples was WLR in Waterford. So I have all the material from the closure of that day. And it was a big development. And they went on, WLR, to become the station of record in Waterford since then, and gone on to great success.
Indeed, they were one of the few pirates that essentially became licensed as they were. I think Midwest Radio in Mayo was the other example in 1989 as well.
And I think that's a tribute to the fact that the station, under Des's leadership, but I like to think it had some small part to play in it, that we deliberately set out to create a professional operation that had its roots in the mayhem of the late 70s, but had made that journey to respectability and to being professional.
So do you think, was WLR then, just looking more generally at the station, was it more community-focused or more commercial in its focus, or was it a kind of a hybrid?
It was a hybrid. It had a very clear community focus. It always had a substantial mid-morning programme that featured, because we couldn't get the local politicians. Maybe in a way it was a positive thing. Because we couldn't get local politicians, we had to go with local organisations, local groups, and to give them a voice. So in many ways, that might have been part of its success. The very fact that small pressure groups or representative groups or self-help groups knew they could get airtime in WLR to talk about their problems. Whereas maybe if we had been able to broadcast the full range of political coverage, we might have ignored those organisations in favour of the local TD. So in a way, a relationship was built between the station and the groups in the communities, the youth groups, the football teams, the rugby teams, people that were day-to-day ordinary folk, not in national politics or local politics, but maybe people who had were doing a lot in their own time and voluntarily for people. They got a voice. And maybe that's what stood to WLR when the time came. So that's a valid point, I think, going forward in terms of how the station decided it would tap into the community. It had some really quirky things. For instance, there was the woman is dead now, but Mother Eukaria used to do the rosary on WLR at 7 every evening. And I used to come on at 7 o'clock. This went on from the very early days. It was that Des and Rick believed that, you know, they would try and tap into the older community. So there was a woman called a nun called Mother Eukaria from the Order of Mercy nuns in Waterford. Every night, Monday to Friday, did a decade of the rosary. And those of us in studio had to pray along to do the response. Now, I was only thinking about this last night. I was thinking about stories and saying, you know, I actually remember this well because the receptionist come newsreader used to sit in with her to do the response. But she would give you the eye across the table to expect you to respond. So I used to do the response as well. But what she didn't know was I had the slider down. So it didn't go out on air. because I'm afraid it wasn't my cup of tea at all. But
every night, Monday to Friday,
and that went on. I'm sure right up to the woman, as I say, has deceased quite some time. Hugely popular woman in Waterford, has to be said. I mean, it wasn't just any old nun. Mother Ugeri was well known in the city. But it was a particular, and if you Des did attempt to take it off the air, and there were actually protests to the station to have it restored. There was a lobby of a small protest to the station door to have her returned. Yeah.
So, what difference do you think the station made to the city?
Waterford is an interesting town, and I'm very conscious of living here in Dublin for the last 30 years. Waterford sees itself as being the forgotten city out of the five, and it certainly felt that way in the 70s. It was a bleak. We had a port dispute that went on for 8 years, so there hadn't been any ships coming into the port, which was a major part of our industry in Waterford and industrial life. Waterford Glass was still strong in the 80s. It was a very strong trade union centre, but it was a bleak town. There was quite a bit of unemployment. The city was quite grey, and WLR and Shoreside and ABC, which came along subsequently, and other smaller pirates that came around, there was Crystal City Sound and a range of others, they all brought a bit of life to the city because most of them were local people and were very much associated with the local community. And in that sense, I think the local radio station was very much part of shoring up a city that felt pretty bad about itself in the 70s and 80s.
Owen Renane reminiscing about WLR, which closed down 30 years ago. And in order to commemorate December the 31st, 1988, the website pirate.ie will be broadcasting online between Christmas and New Year, playing jingles, recordings, songs, outtakes, air checks and interviews from the Pirate Radio Archive. Make sure you tune in then.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. Follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt.
The annual meeting of community radio broadcasters, the Craol Féile, took place on the 13th and 14th of October in Athlone. The weekend was hosted by Athlone Community Radio and includes a series of workshops about community radio and the annual Craol Achievement Awards, which recognise exceptional programming on community radio. And by the way, congratulations to Flirt FM shows The Galway Gamer and Trivia Matters, who both won silver awards. Here's a report from this year's Féile.
I'm Declan Gibbons, manager of Community Radio Kilkenny City and also chair of the Craol Coordinating Committee.
Can I ask you, maybe just for listeners who are not fully au fait with what's going on in the sector, to give us a little overview maybe of the state of community radio in Ireland at the moment. How many stations are we talking about between full-time and part-time and aspirant stations and so on? If you can just maybe paint that picture for us.
Sure, there's 21 full-time, as in fully licensed stations with a 10-year licence. Most of those are in at the moment, and members of Craol, full members. And then there's close enough to that number again, a little bit less in the development stage, I like to call it, because that could be from people who have put together a group but have never broadcast, to people that are in the process of negotiating a licence with the BAI, having run a series of perhaps 30 and 100 day licences, and they're geographically spread all over the country. But the 21 are the full members and maybe are the ones that drive the agenda. A big issue is that as chair of Craol and with a couple of my colleagues on the committee, we have over the past this calendar year been engaged with the Broadcasting Authority on really essentially what's called a community media forum. Ourselves and the community television sector have been sitting down with the BAI looking at two essential things, participation and sustainability. And I think one is essential to the other. And I think there is a real feeling in the sector that it's, while it's really important, maybe there isn't a wider view there. The public isn't aware on a national sense of the role of community radio and all the stuff that it's doing. And I think that's something that, you know, we have to, because we're all it's volunteer based and there's small staffs in all of the stations, we're working 100% flat out, trying to do stuff for our community and do stuff for people. And even if we could stop, and one of the things I'm coming to the conclusion of is that if we could stop and spend maybe 10% of the time assessing what we've done and valuing that ourselves and then telling everybody about it, well, I think there's a huge value in that. And the participation and the sustainability of the sector, because as I said, it is a fairy tale sector. There's huge professional work goes into it, whether it's on a volunteer basis or otherwise. I think it's providing a huge value to the community, but we need to find a way to reflect that. And ultimately, we're talking to the Broadcasting Authority as well about finding a way of funding that. Now, they're not going to do that unless we actually show them that we can show them that we can measure, we can demonstrate, use whichever word you like, but the value of community radio, and that it is something that should be funded, and that whether in the definition of the Act it's public service broadcasting, it is certainly providing a public service.
Because surely the absence of that core funding must be an enormous threat to the sustainability of the sector. We have had stations that have been lost along the way, and one could argue that after 20 years of community radio, 21 full-time stations is a pretty small number.
You could argue that, and certainly, for instance, I said at the AGM yesterday, we in Kilkenny City, and you interviewed me pretty much a year ago, John. We're the newest station on air. We're not quite 12 months on air at this stage. We should be the second newest. A station in Tramore actually was recommended by the Contracts Awards Committee to become the next station. And ultimately, that group unravelled. Now, I can't, and it wouldn't be appropriate to go into the details about a particular group and what was the cause of that. But one of the things that I'm really concerned, and I was really upset about that, because it's in my neighbouring area, it's in the southeast. We trained some of the people involved when I was involved in Yall, and we did that 7.5 years ago. There's a decade of work went into that, and that group unravelled. There's a piece around the licensing process, and we're trying to say to the Broadcasting Authority, it's too long, it's too immeasurable. After you've done a temporary license, the BAI don't tell you, well, you did that right, you did that wrong. They just maybe tell you what you did wrong, but don't tell you what you did right. And that's not something that'll cost anybody any money, but it needs to be tightened up. So, yes, and I think because there is a role and there is room for new stations to come on, but there's no point in setting up new stations if they're not going to survive. And we've got to try and provide a pathway for that survival and something that's sustainable.
And do you sense that any progress is being made? Is this ultimately political? Is more lobbying needed of legislators? Does the Broadcasting Act need to change? Or is it a multitude of issues?
Yeah, I think it's a multi-pronged thing. I think we're in negotiation with the BI, and their hands are tied to a degree by legislation. But I think it's no harm for them, and as you're aware, BAI representatives here, and to actually get the reaction from the grassroots, from people about how they feel and the value that they put on it. And so we'll argue that case, and I think our armoury is improved by the BAI having exposure to that. But also, I totally agree that it is a case of advocacy, call it lobbying advocacy. We have got to talk to the politicians, and we're working on that, to get community radio into the policies of the political parties ahead of the next general election. I think that's coming in the not too distant future, whether it's within the next 12 months, I expect it. I don't have any special information on that. And I think we've got to get in there, because if we're in there, we can't be ignored. But it is, as I said, a multi-pronged approach, because the BAI are the people who know and who govern broadcasting. And so we've got to influence them as well, because obviously if they pass a message up, that will help our other lobbying.
And to come back to Kilkenny, you mentioned Kilkenny. You're about a year on the air now, I think. Community Radio Kilkenny City, as you said, the country's most recent full-time licensed community station. So a year on, how are you feeling, and how is the progress?
Progress is very good, John, thanks. And feeling a bit exhausted after it, but in a good way, because the response has been really good from the community. There was a lot of goodwill there over all the temporary license phase, and there was just a general goodwill towards the station. But I always said that that goodwill will only get you so far, and it won't sustain you unless we do good programming, we make a good impact on the community apart from programming. And I think we're doing that. And one of the things that's coming up is people are saying, like, for instance, we Monday to Thursday only go on air midday to 7 p.m. only, but we're broadcasting 73 hours a week across 7 days. People want us on in the morning, and they kind of, there's a gap there. So we're in the process of negotiating with the BAI to extend that to 97 hours or 98 hours per week. We're hoping that'll happen in the next few months. And so I think that's responding to a need. And also volunteers, we had 85 volunteers, say 12 months ago. We have 106 now. That doesn't mean there's 50 people in the building at any given time. But those people are all contributing on a regular basis to the station. So, yeah, quite good.
And how are you finding the spread of programmes and the diversity and the range of programmes then? Are you reaching the targets that you set out for yourself?
We are, yeah. There are some challenges, and, you know, in the nature of a volunteer operation, if a key person, a person, say, with an arts programme, for instance, which in our own case has just happened, the main person behind that has just left because, thankfully, they've got a full-time job and won't, you know, there's a gap there. So we're working to say to try and fill that. And that's going to be always a kind of a challenge. Equally, we have a multicultural programme, but I'd also like to have, say, a programme that, say, recognise specifically the Polish community or the Lithuanian community, which are quite strong in our area. I'd like that in our new extended schedule, but I'm having trouble finding the people. And, you know, because I think in some of the workshops that we're on today, it's about, you know, are we really reflecting the community? Because I think community radio should be more than club, but the challenge is it's not just reaching out, but it's having those people accept you're reaching out and actually to respond to it.
Well, I think there was a very powerful comment earlier on in the session that we both attended about how somebody with an intellectual disability would have been shown the door in so many different places, but found his niche in this local community radio station. I think that really seems to me to sum up the potential that exists with community radio. So I presume that's something that's very dear to your own heart.
Yeah, and it's something that's happening in every station, possibly every week, but certainly every month, because, you know, you can't make a huge impact on somebody on a given week. But I think it's something that stations are engaged in on an ongoing basis. And we'd have experience with that. We've one particular individual with an intellectual disability who comes into us every single week and has a particular slot. And we just had a meeting 2 weeks ago to assess how that's going. And it's having a huge impact on his life and then on the life of his family as well. And obviously that's recognised by his carers. We're talking also about getting involved with people who are even more challenged. For instance, people who actually don't have speech skills, and exploring how, because they can communicate what they're interested in. Like, for instance, we're actually looking at the possibility of a rock program with somebody who hasn't got verbal communication skills, and that we'd use social media to communicate that these are the preferences of this individual. And, like, it's amazing what can be done, but obviously it's resources are a constant thing, because to do stuff like that, you need time to actually just stop and think about doing it before you even do it at all. But, you know, I'm excited about all the work that's going on in the stations. We one of the stations in Dublin, Phoenix FM, they just ran a drama project that involved a drama in 30 individual houses in the Dublin 15 area. The stuff that's going on is amazing, and a little bit of support would go an awful long way in the sector.
You're listening to Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3, and we're coming today from the annual Craol Féile in Athlone, which this year is hosted by Athlone Community Radio. And I'm joined by one of the people involved with the local station here, Irena Jack Zetkovic, who came to Ireland from Serbia quite a few years ago now, I think, Irena?
It is almost 19 years. I come here in 2000, long, long time ago.
And what inspired you to get involved in community radio in Ireland?
Well, I have journalism, BA in journalism, and I thought I will never ever kind of work as a journalist in some other country on my second language. And I was like, what will I do? So while I was doing a practice for some computer course, I chose Roscommon Community Radio. So just to be around, like to see how the media works. And I heard about this Sound and Vision that is the funding for radio documentaries. And although I did have my practice in TV back home, back in Serbia, in Belgrade, like I never actually work on radio. So it was a big challenge for me. So I was successful and I look, and I was doing then just not, I was not there just to do database, you know, like kind of, I was there to kind of make a program for Ross FM. And then I met a few people there, and few of us from Roscommon actually set up the radio station in Athlone, because we were all Athlonians. And then we really, like from infancy, like from the beginning, we set up the community radio. And I'm with Athlone Community Radio since the first public meetings 11, 12 years ago.
And obviously then the ethos of community radio is really important for you. What does it mean to you?
I didn't know about, like, kind of, I think Ireland has a different and other, even in Europe, it's even recognized through Broadcasting Act that there is like community radio, community media, and they're independent and they're kind of certain radios that they're covering. But there's this ethos, which is very important. We believe that there is no big stars and everyone can do loads of things at the radio. Everyone has a story to tell and a great voice. And we find something for everyone. You can just do the research or you can just do a technical thing. And it's, I think, the wider mix of people that you can meet anywhere. And if you talk about community development or anything that you can help benefit community, like you think about community radio, because where else, look at yourself, you're a lecturer who is in community radio. We have a psychotherapist who was there. We have an urban planner who is there. We had someone from active age group. We have someone who is recovered alcoholic, like kind of. We have a kid from transition years. Like where else you can meet kind of that kind of, it's such an interesting and absolutely very creative environment, lively, dynamic. It's just great.
And one of the most creative things you've been doing has been documentary making. You've made a lot of documentaries. You've spoken to us at the Craol Féile today and yesterday about those documentaries. So can you tell us about your experience of that, and how did you get into documentary making? How have you become such a proficient documentary maker?
Oh, God. Well, I think it helped me my journalism background. So this kind of, research, you know, that all helps you in it. And I think, you know, it's always your own personality, your drive, you know, you want to tell a story. As I said, documentaries, storytelling, I love that. And I just, you know, like kind of when I think of something, it's important to say, I like the creative process of getting an angle to it and how to tell the story. So one of my first one, and I just look around and have an idea. So being in Athlone, but actually the local historian told me, we need a girl from Serbia to come to Athlone and actually make a program about Gentex, John Cantman Corum, John Broderick, Athlone calling my drum, because people are here, take that for granted. And I, coming from outside, I said, you have the world famous tenor, like kind of, you have a writer that was banned and gay, and you have the first radio mast, and no one up till now make a documentary. So, that's what
I think. Is it your outsider status that makes you more aware of what's happening in a place like this?
Yeah. Well, I think they all got used to, like, I heard about Gentex, like, kind of. Gentex is such a popular documentary because the people from all over the world who ever had any connection with Athlone, it's such a local story, but everyone, because could you imagine that time in 1930s that the one enterprise in any town in Ireland and not in Athlone that at that time have like 12,000 people, 1,000 people work in a textile industry.
So Gentex was a textile industry.
Gentex, a textile industry that has a put up from the old wool mills that was on the Shannon in Athlone. Yeah. But then they start, but it's such a lovely story because it's a story about, you know, it's what Guinness was for Dublin, that was Gentex for the whole area. So everyone was working there, but it's such a camaraderie there. Like at that time. Like, people lived differently, respect was different. And it's such a great story. And everyone has someone in the family who work in Gentex. That's why it's such a popular documentary, from people all over the world is actually going back to Gentex. So you think it's not what is there because it's just only a textile industry. But then it's such a great story because why textile industry? The Belgian people come. They were a great weaver. So they put Belgium. That's why we have Belgium kind of set of house in Athlone. So I'm just saying, even if you think something is just so boring and where is the story, you actually have a great story there. Do you know, like, kind of, and if, you know, the way you set the documentary, it starts with the side of weaver, you know, like, kind of, and it's not, it's just not a story about its decline of textile industry. Where is the cotton coming from, you know? Because they were the only one that make a cotton from a duck for doctors, for hospitals. And then the cheap cottons came, you know? Okay. It's a story about everything. And it's actually just like kind of... And you think it's like factory, not law. Like, who wants to kind of...
So what's your approach then? You mentioned earlier storytelling with sound. So how does that work in a practical sense? You mentioned the sound of the loom, I think, weaving the sounds in the factory.
Yeah, that's how it started. And not just that, like kind of because people went to at the same time there, you wouldn't believe in town it was at that time. I'm not lying. It's like the whole town knows. It's not just for Gen. The whole town had a siren to tell everyone to wake up at 6 in the morning. So they are going to Gentex. Not in Gentex, like in the town, so people know. So I have a sound of a siren as well. Like, isn't that just brilliant? Yeah, I think it's great. And not just for that, for every documentary. I always think about sounds. That's very important for me. I want to tell a story. I want to pace the story. I want to pace the atmosphere. I want to tell... emphasize things, you know, through sound. So I think everyone who is involved with radio have to think about the background, the foreground, what connect certain things, you know, the story that you are telling, what kind of sound you're connected with it. Like, as I said, if you it's happy, you know, like kind of the, just get the background, gets everything kind of lively, happier, just get the mood of the documentary, set up the mood of the documentary, you know, in it.
And what other programs have you made that you're particularly happy with or particularly proud of? You mentioned Athlone Calling earlier on.
Oh, I love Athlone Calling. Athlone Calling, I think it's for its national importance, was the Moidrom transmitter. So the history of the radio. So we are radio, like, who else? Like, that's why we were pushing for funding of this. Who else to make this than our own radio station being in Athlone, but Moidrom, you know.
Athlone, of course, famous on radio dials all over the continent from the 1930s onwards.
Absolutely. Athlone was there with Paris and Luxembourg, and there is a town before Dublin, before anyone, everything else, Athlone was on radio dial. And if you want to listen to this documentary, if you go on Mixcloud, you will actually see the photo, and on that photograph you can literally see Athlone on radio dial. It's a story, it's a national story that you can involve Eamon de Valera, who have a speech around it, John Count McCormack. You can involve religion because, like, Eucharistic Congress was actually, before official opening, the first broadcast was from Eucharistic Congress. And you know how at that time, how big that was, like a million people, like, come on, like, and if you can't even come any close to anything like that at the time. And it involved a lot of local people, like active age group, people who grown up with radio, and the passion and the emotion they're talking about the radio, and they remember everything, those family rocks on the, I don't even know why I did this, but they remember hospital wishes, like, kind of, there was, like, if you're in hospital, like, kind of, play music for you or something. And Don LeBou and all this kind of start of the radio. But they're actually remembering that time, well, all was well, you know. And the way they're talking about radio is beautiful. But then you have technical side of it, because in Athlone is, like, the only intact Marconi equipment. All three generations of the radio equipment is in Athlone, we hope, to have a radio museum there, and that's part of that documentary as well. This kind of citizens coming together, organizing a group, like really grassroots movement. And it's like we are on its way now, like to get the museum. Is that great? You know, and it's in our documentary documented.
Irena Jack-Tsvetkovich of Athlone Community Radio, ending that report from the Craill Féile in Athlone. We had a wonderful time and even squeezed in a visit to the old RTE transmitter site at Moydrum, mentioned by Irena in that interview. And we hope to be back and see the inside next time. And that brings us to the end of this month's edition of Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3. We'll be back on the first Monday in December with more radio news from home and abroad. I do hope you can join us then. But in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Wireless Flirt and on facebook.com/wirelessflirt. Until the next edition of Wireless, this is John Walsh wishing you good listening.
Wireless on Flirt FM 101.3.